Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rituparna Padgiri, and today I'm going to be in conversation with Tina Sikka. Tina Sikka is a reader in technoscience and intersectional justice in the School of Arts and Culture at Newcastle University, UK. Her current research includes the critical and intersectional study of science applied to climate change, bodies and health, as well as research on consent, sexuality, and restorative justice. Sikka also works in the areas of decolonization, bordering practices, and DEI. In today's conversation, we'll be talking about her very interesting book that I had a chance to recently read, Health Apps, Genetic Diets, and Superfoods, When Biopolitics Meets Neoliberalism, which has been published by Bloomsbury in 2023. Tina, I'm so glad that you're doing this, and welcome to NBN.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Right. So let me just begin by asking you a little bit about the context in which this book is located, if you could, you know, talk us through it.
Sure. So the book itself is a contemporary analysis of technologies like health apps, examining foods, superfoods, in a historical context. So looking at modern understandings of how health have evolved and how our ideas about health has evolved. So out of the context of neoliberalism, austerity and privatization, and things like cuts to healthcare, a rise in seeing health as a commodity, I think all of those factors go in. And I also pay a lot of attention in the book to a context that is gendered and racialized, and is also quite ableist in many ways as well.
Interesting that you mentioned, you know, about ableism as well, because it brings me to my next question about what your field site is and what are the methods that you use in the study?
Yeah, so navigating the digital terrain is one area in particular that I do focus on. So a lot of, you know, looking at media coverage, looking at different websites, looking at the way health is discursively constructed online. So apps, websites, online conversations and services. I look at media as a sort of field site as well. So newspapers and digital media outlets, but also like the kitchen, and in my kitchen in particular, the body is a field site as well. And methodologically, I use a multiple kind of mixed methods approach. So I'm drawing on autoethnography or auto theory, political economy, new materialism, and discourse analysis are kind of the major methods that I use.
Right. So could you also talk a little bit about your theoretical and conceptual frameworks?
Sure. So the approach that I take is critical, looking at relations of power, ideas of justice. It's very intersectional. So looking at the ways that gender, race, class, sexuality overlap and are expressed through conceptions of health. I think I have a kind of theoretical and conceptual commitment to equity and social justice in the work as well. So looking at opportunities for material redistribution, transformations to how health knowledge is produced and used. Autoethnography is something that I rely on quite a bit in the book, and really trying to think about how autoethnography is a valid and significant form of research practice. So engaging with lived experience as the object of study around health, looking at my own feelings and experiences, so readers can kind of see if it resonates with their own responses, but really undergirded by research literature and analytic insights. But social change is really something that I I focus on quite a bit in the book. And that dimension of social change comes out with the critical discourse analysis, looking at how language and the way that health is talked about can perpetuate unequal relations of power and marginalization. And I think that is really important when it comes to health. And then I also have new materialism, which shifts the focus from language to embodiment and, you know, challenging that binary of, you know, the discursive and the embodied in any way that I can.
Right. Could you also talk about how you understand the idea of health and healthy bodies?
Yeah, and I do, towards the end of the book, go through and talk about what I think a more capacious understanding of health would consist of. And I talk about it as health as justice. So looking at conceptions of well-being, how things are embodied and are relational, how you feel about your place in the world. And I have certain tenets that I've got incorporated. So, you know, looking at health as co-constituted, that you have to look at it as an assemblage, looking at values, institutions, practices, technologies, thinking about health as embodied and relational, focusing on social determinants, so not being super individualizing when it comes to health, intersectional and really attending to things like equality. I talk about care quite a bit in the book also, and community. Freedom from pain and disease as being significant as well. Health is pleasurable, I think, is an important factor, and it pleasurable as it relates to food and movement. I do take a very kind of anti-commercial and anti-consumerist understanding of health, and something that I think is sort of counter-hegemonic as it relates to diverse kinds of bodies and differences, that it has to be encompassing in order to really be about health.
Right. And this is connected to my, you know, next question about what is this idea of good health? Is it also hegemonic?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I would say if we think about hegemonic health, the idea of something being hegemonic being something that is difficult to kind of transform or change or critique. So I wouldn't say that good health is hegemonic health, because it would be in a position then where it would be beyond or difficult to critique or amend or change. And so I would say that hegemonic health is something that we look at as being really part of this, what I call the dietary, genomic, functional, superfood industrial complex, which is sort of a mouthful, but it's this idea that there's this juggernaut of dietary, technological understandings of health that have become industrialized and is really oriented towards profit and profit motives. And that, you know, it hegemonic health is, you know, in the definition I provide, gives a lot of room for very idealized expectations about what the body is supposed to do and look like. It's very consumer oriented. It's very gendered and racialized and classed, that it also is coercive, and it reflects Western standards of health and wellness in particular. So I think good health would be something that would challenge those things, but it would never become hegemonic, because it would always be something that would be open to critique and reevaluation.
Interesting. And you did mention the dietary, genomic, functional, superfood industrial complex. So is it possible to expand on it a little bit about its history and about its connection to, you know, capitalism?
Yeah, and I do take a very critical approach in that sense as well. So I think about the dietary, genomic, functional, superfood industrial complex as kind of an assemblage. So like an ecosystem of health and health adjacent corporations that profit off of the desire for quote unquote good health, where good health here is understood as hegemonic health, but it's a moving target. So it's about regulating the body, commodifying health, instrumentalizing food. And it's about, you know, creating the good producer and the good laborer and the good kind of citizen subject, which is really, you know, part of that kind of neoliberal umbrella. So looking at health apps in particular, any kind of monitoring devices fit into this, into this superfood industrial complex, genetic testing, personalized diets, superfoods, functional foods, and that sort of dominates the sector. So it really has become an economic sector.
Right. Interesting. And then I have to actually ask you about technology. I mean, what role does technology play today in monitoring health?
So it's one that is ambivalent. So it's one about surveillance for sure, and really instrumentalization of the body and embodiment in particular. I think there's also a tendency for technology to reinscribe hegemonic values around race and good bodies, what constitutes good bodies, thin femininity and hypermasculinity and youthfulness. But it doesn't have to be that way. And so I do draw on scholarship in the area of technofeminism to think about how we might be able to transform existing technologies in pursuit of justice-oriented ends, or perhaps create new devices and artifacts that attend to human needs and capacities. And that's a lot of scholarship in critical race studies and in feminist science studies that is looking at, you know, how we could, at the level of design and the level of assumptions built into the technologies, create ones that move past this, you know, complex that I've spoke about.
Right. And again, you know, wondering, what is your take on the political economy of the personalized diet industry?
Sure. So I came out as a scholar out of media studies, and while political economy is its own discipline, a lot of the work that I have done has looked at political economy in the context of communication theory. So Vincent Mosco, who's a Canadian communications scholar who passed away, unfortunately, quite recently, talks about political economy as a study of social relations that constitute the production, distribution, and consumption of communication resources. So I sort of take that and I look at it in terms of health resources. So what are the social relations that constitute the production, distribution, and consumption of health resources? So looking at ownership, you know, looking at concentration, profit-making, capitalism, sort of like the system of organization of power relations, looking at monopolies, looking at different ways in which businesses are vertically and horizontally integrated. And taking that political economic view sort of gives you an idea of how the business of health is structured. And I think that is often missed, or it's sort of seen as a different area outside of you know, the other work that I'm doing.
Very interesting. You know, so how can one understand superfoods? Could you also give some examples?
Sure. Superfoods in particular, it's difficult because there's no real definition of superfoods that sort of that spans industries or that the medical community agrees on, or in nutritional or food science. It's lies within more of a marketing term. So it's foodstuffs and dietary supplements that are believed to contain like a particular beneficial set of properties that are health promoting. So vitamins, minerals, and they're believed to fight or prevent diseases that are degenerative. So antioxidants, phytochemicals, enzymes. And mostly they're visible in foods like goji berries, kale, acai, wheatgrass, green tea, turmeric. And it's really interesting because a lot of them are framed as exotic and rare and kind of hidden from Western culture. They have like magical properties, almost like a health halo or health capital. But I think there, one of the things I was interested in examining is how they're implicated in cycles of post-colonial economic and cultural exploitation. So you get these sort of images of, you know, the non-Western other and, you know, these magical foods that you can sort of then appropriate and use for very instrumentalized purposes.
Right. I have a couple of last questions. Number one is, would you say that your work is interdisciplinary in nature? And also, what do you think is the scope of study in this particular area in the future?
Yeah, so in terms of it being interdisciplinary, absolutely. I think in my analysis and methodologically, I'm borrowing from a really vast array of disciplines. So things like gender studies, media studies, political economy, critical race theory. I even draw quite a bit from fat studies and cultural studies. And I think the mixed methods approach is also interdisciplinary in nature. And in terms of future work, I'm really interested in further applications of autoethnography and thinking about lived experience and health. I'm also interested in more intersectional approaches, which I think are really looking at the mechanisms by which health is instantiated in bodies that are gendered and racialized and classed and disabled, and how we kind of think about those bodies as good bodies and bad bodies, and how they are implicated in cycles of capital and capitalism that can be exploitative, and really trying to think through different futures of what health can look like.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Tina, for talking to me today. And it was a very, you know, crisp conversation. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I hope that our listeners also enjoy it. So thank you once again for, you know, doing this podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.